welcome to Comic Talk today for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. Man, C2E2 is almost here, by the way. Very excited. I am leaving my house in exactly 7 days. And I'm going to be in Chicago for like 5. Don't tell my wife. I'm just kidding. My wife is. Anyways, if you're going to be in Chicago next week, let me know. Find me on Twitter at Geekvine. And we'll hang out. I know there's going to be a bunch of us over there, so it'll be very exciting. You can't crash at our place, but you can't hang out with us. Anyways, today's episode is a chat that I recorded with Kevin Eastman this past weekend at SC Comic Con 2019. It was pretty awesome, actually. I'd never seen Kevin Eastman in person. I actually sat next to his wife, Courtney, so that was cool as well. And yeah, enjoy the show. I'll be back tomorrow with another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
So while everybody's getting situated, I guess we'll get us started. I want to start right from the beginning. I guess we're talking about 1983, 84, right? Is that, if you want to go back further, you can. I'm curious. Okay, so you and Peter are sitting around wondering, like, or trying to figure out what project you're going to do,
yes.
And how... Like, how did you develop the turtles? When did you know that the turtles was the thing to move ahead?
Well, the whole thing was completely accidental in many ways, and actually many, many ways. But Pete and I had formed a company called Mirage Studios, and it was a Mirage because it was actually our living room. And we had this, Pete and his wife Janine were renting a house in Dover, New Hampshire, and they had a spare room, and I was cooking lobsters. Our main accent comes right back when we say lobsters. The lobsters up in
the lobsters up there.
Up in the harbor.
Wicked cool.
It was wicked cool. Like chowder. So I finished work that summer cooking lobsters, and he said, "Hey, you know, we'd already met before, and because we were I met him actually." Taking a step back, I met him. I was trying to sell some of my cartoons to this magazine that I found on the bus between Amherst and Northampton, Massachusetts, and it's called Scat, and I took it. I gathered my portfolio, I went to the Scat offices and tried to sell them some of my jokes and some of my cartoons, and they said, "Well, we don't really do the kind of work you're doing, but you should meet this guy, Peter Laird. He's another local artist that draws the same, you know, weird stuff you do." And so I wrote Peter a letter, and Bethany did those things back in those days. And
Before emails.
Before texts.
You actually put stuff on paper? Wow.
And a stamp.
Whoa.
By myself. And we hit it off right away over first time I went to Pete's studio, he had a original art a pencil page from Jack Kirby, and I just lost my mind. I was a huge Jack Kirby fan and I'd never seen the Jack Kirby original, so it was quite incredible. He gave it to me years later. We still have it in our collection at home. So we bonded, we started trading ideas, and then I finished do part-time school down in there, and I moved back to Maine, and I was cooking lobsters over the summer, and just coincidentally, Pete moved 20 minutes from where I was working in Maine into New Hampshire. And so he would come up, and we'd noodle and doodle around, and said, "Well, let's form a studio and see if we can get some work." So what we accomplished was getting a lot of rejection letters, which was awesome, but inspiring. We put them up on the wall. And it was probably November of 1983, November of 1983, that... I was just annoying Pete one night, and I was thinking to myself, what's the stupidest thing I could come up with as, at least, how about Bruce Lee as an animal? What would be the dumbest animal it'd be? And so I did this first sketch, which is on our hat here, of a turtle standing upright. He had his mask on and nunchucks, and I put it on his table and said, "This is going to be the next big thing, ha, ha, ha." I was joking.
Somebody was listening.
So he did a sketch and changed some things, and I thought to myself, well, one, why not a group of them? So I did a sketch in pencil of four turtles, each with a different weapon, and wrote in, you know, comic booky, you know, Ninja Turtles on it. And when he inked it in, he had a Teenage Mutant to the title, and we looked at this and said, "This is the dumbest thing we've ever seen." We immediately said, "We have to come up with a story that tells how these characters had to be the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles." And that was November of 83 when that happened. And then by January of 84, we started working on the comic book and completed it by May.
It's a pretty fast turnaround.
Yeah. As we joke, we didn't have any distracting pain work going on. So
when you created the first comic, did you just do like, "Oh, it's going to be a one and done" type thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was, you know, I can't compliment my uncle enough in that he loaned us the money. He was our early form of crowdfunding because he believed we had to borrow the money to actually print the book.
Sure.
We did this full budget. We got our print quotes. We put together an advertising plan, how to sell them through the mail, and how we'd pay him back within the next 60 or 70 years. So we ended up printing exactly 3,000 copies, and it was one of those things that we said, well, if we sell a couple hundred, you know, that would be awesome. And
that's just went from there.
It just started selling, and it's all your fault, by the way. Thank you, by the way. Brian was back when it was
there. Your uncle's like, I should have asked for a cut.
I'm sure he was well compensated.
we sorted him out, yeah. We took good care of him. But it was great. He was at, so we printed 3,000 copies, and I went back to Cooking Lobsters for that summer. And throughout the summer, we sold out of the 3,000 copies, and we did another printing of 6,000 copies. And then by the time I finished work that fall, you know, Pete and I talked pretty much every day, and he said, well, people keep calling and asking when we're going to do a second issue. And we were like, we never thought the first issue would sell enough to warrant a second issue. So in fall of 84, we started working on issue two.
That was awesome.
Wow, it's a great story. I'm a New England boy, Massachusetts, New Hampshire border. I'm an independent creator, and you're like, you guys are, you and Ben, you know, creator of the Tick, you guys are like a legend to us.
Yeah, I love Ben. Ben's doing quite well for himself. He's like, is Gotham one of the main?
Yeah, I think, he's been doing TV work mostly last, and I think, well, he...
I should ask him for a cut.
And he's got the Tick series on Amazon.
That's right.
He's all in charge of that too. So,
man, I love the original because my wife Courtney and I were, I think, for about 6 or 7 years, we'd watch Rules of Engagement nightly before we crashed out. But I love Patrick Warburton's The Tick.
So oh yeah,
it was too short lived, but it was an awesome series.
Just the voice, even when I see him on anything else, Tick.
Yeah. Awesome. We got questions.
Yeah, sure.
We got questions.
First of all, this line is a whole lot shorter than the one talk. Yesterday.
I talked too much anyway.
Second of all, you guys kind of stomped all over this. My question was, what was the first thing that your uncle said to you when this first came?
I want a cut. No, he was great. You know, it's funny because his mom, my grandmother was a painter, and so she was a big inspiration. My artistic talent was definitely inherited. My father used to doodle a lot, and his brothers and stuff. And so in Quentin at the time was selling art supplies, a company called Charpak. And so I used to get discounts for all my art supplies. But he was just super supportive and just thought, you know, this is an interesting idea. And he was aware, you know, of comics and, he wasn't a, serious comic reader or collector, but he was aware of what was going on and just thought it was kind of cool and thought, you know, and I mean, we did. We invited him over the house, we scheduled a meeting, and we had this full business plan. So it was, you know, we weren't just saying, hey, dude, can you loan us some money? This is how we'll pay you back.
That was really, in early 80s, that was really risky, too. I mean, to even have an idea of getting your money back, let alone reaching the kind of success that you did. The fact that, you know, when I ask for support, I mean, thanks to you, people can go, oh, yeah, that did happen a couple times. But back then, it wasn't happening.
No,
a lot of people must have told you, like, no.
Well, no, you know, what was interesting, though, was he's, you know, fortunately he was the only, I mean, no, he was the only one that we really asked, but he helped us right away. But it was a very interesting time in comics in that, you know, because we had a lot of models that we were looking at and some of the stuff that was actually working, things like Dave Sim did a comic called Cerebus, the Aardvark, which was started in, I think, mid-70s. And he was having some success with that. And Wendy and Richard Pini with a book called ElfQuest, which was really, really popular.
Amazing stuff.
Flaming Carrot was, I think, another one out there around the time.
Top.
And it looked pop.
Yeah, we were out in the Atlanta area. So, yeah.
Bob
pops up all the time.
I actually slept at your house or something. No, I love Bob. It's like he's
one of the fun. Let me tell you Mystery Man. I can tell you all.
I love that movie, by the way. It was one of those, like, that Mystery Man movie.
Was fantastic. Oh, yeah.
But there was, even a bit further, my dad was, familiar. He was a big fan of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. And so I was sort of tuned into, underground comics and self-publishers, but it was really kind of Dave Sim and this new group of Sim as a self-publisher and creator owner, and Wendy and Richard Pini and all that stuff. That was really, that was in my, my wheelhouse as far as my age group. And you could see the possibility, well, these guys are doing it, so maybe, just maybe.
They were totally paving the way for you. They were your inspiration more for not going off the Superman, Batman, DC, Marvel.
Totally. Yeah, cause it was because it's funny because in many ways, Heavy Metal Magazine led me to a lot of these guys in that the early issues of Heavy Metal Magazine that came out in 1977. Some of those issues had original works by Vaughn Bode and Richard Corbin and things like that, and I became infatuated with not only heavy metal but those artists in particular. And again, growing up in Maine, we would make on a day off, a buddy of mine that read comics would make a pilgrimage down to Million Year Picnic, which was in central Boston. And that was, they had this huge selection of underground comic books, and that's where we found like Cerebus and some of these guys. And we were just like, and even then it was in the world of comic books, they had the direct market distribution, which is a non-returnable system. Like most Marvel and DC, as you guys all know, it's like it was, they shipped them to those spinner racks and grocery stores and drug stores, and they were all returnable, which isn't economically feasible to a lot of self-publishers, but the direct comic market was a solicitor for your books, they'd place orders and...
But this is also the era of local comic book distributors, because you didn't have Diamond being the monopoly like it is nowadays. So you probably had to contact each one of them to try to get your comic.
And that's, it's too bad, and that's, it's, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's really sad that that whole system went away. When we did distribution on Turtles, like reprint of 1, 2, and 3, there was about 26 small distributors from Heroes World, Sunrise, Capital Comics, there was a lot of these guys that made it to the ship and distribute, similar to what they were doing, a lot of record, distribute records and vinyl and all kinds of interesting...
All the different labels and such.
Yeah, so that was, and then when Diamond really messed things up.
The attack of Steve Jobs.
Exactly.
We've got a question out there.
Yes, sir.
You talked about your initial distribution and that first run of 2000. How much, what's the most you've seen one of those, that initial run, go for compared to what you initially sold?
Well, we would, it's funny because we were selling them $1.50 plus 50 cents postage back then. And it's, I've seen it varied. I think like crazy varied in that. I think there was a 9.4, 9.6 a couple of years ago that went almost for $20,000, which I think was exceptionally, and I've never seen that again. Most of the ones we've seen, because even, the quality of the books, the printer that we were working with in New Hampshire, it was so small, and it was this really cheap newsprint, and really, everything was really cheap. the newsprint started yellowing while it was still on press, practically. some of them were cropped really weird and stuff, so it's, to get, see a really nice version, but I think the average around 5,000.
And you don't see a dime?
No. I don't see a dime. No, it's
not one of those.
No, actually, I sold my interest in the Turtles probably 20 years ago, and it's interesting because I sold my interest initially to Pete, and then Pete sold it to Viacom, and then when Viacom started relaunching the Turtles, they basically called me, and so I ended up being brought back into the world of Turtles, and what an incredible blessing it's been. It's just been, I probably had as much fun, like I mainly work on the IDW comic series right now, and I have as much fun, it's almost as much fun as I did originally working with Peter, because I get to work with guys like Tom Waltz, and that comic story is the closest you probably ever get to the original Mirage series, and that it's totally intended for an older audience, so it's got a bit more of an edge to it. We're going to be hitting issue 100 November, I think. Thank you guys.
It was interesting because when you started your comic, it was a very adult theme. Mm-hmm. And then when they announced that they're going to make a cartoon out of it, it was like they almost Disney-fied it in a lot of ways. And what was your reaction to that? Bring me the money.
Making it rain. Now, one of the things is, it's a great question because, Peter and I were, huge, both huge fans of Jack Kirby. And Siegel and Schuster and Steve Gerber and so many of these guys that, Jack Kirby in particular created most of the Marvel Universe that even Stan Lee takes credit for, and rest in peace, Stan. But it was like, but that was the nature of the business. A lot of those guys worked for Work for Hire. So all those ideas that they came up with owned by the company. So brilliant guy like Jack Kirby, who created, you know, again, the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and some of the things, when the company saw success from those things, those creations, he didn't see a penny from those. And so Peter and I knew very early on, we had a clear understanding of that. I mean, even around this time, there was a big industry fight. Guys like Frank Miller and Gary Groth, who published the Comics Journal, and a lot of Mike Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson were really petitioning hard to for creators' rights, the ownership, not only what they created for these companies. Swamp Thing, Len Lean, that was something they created that DC ended up owning. Many more stories. And they, a lot of times they wouldn't even get their artwork back, their original artwork. That was back in those days. So it was a big fight to get Jack Kirby's artwork back. So we, as we went into the animated opportunities with the Turtles, we owned our copyright, we owned our trademark. We were selling probably about 60 or 70,000 copies of a black and white comic book. So we not only could pay our rent, eat, and put a little money in the bank, it made us exceptionally protective and probably even cocky in that. When Hollywood approached, and there were a few different agents that approached us initially, and said, we think this could be toys. We think it could be something much more than a comic book. And we were like, it's a comic book. And you know, this is what it was intended to be, and we don't see what you see in it. And besides, you know, at least the first two agents that approached us, we thought they were untrustworthy. I'm trying to be wicked polite here.
I'm impressed you were able to do that.
Yeah, like, you know, bleep, bleep, agents. But we met this guy, Matt Friedman, who did, he approached us, and he was the same kind of thing. He showed up in our offices in Northampton, Massachusetts, in his $800 suit, perfect hair, you know, this thing. And he's like, you know, I think it could be this, I could be this. And we were like, dude, we, you know, all right, at least you're more tolerable than most of the rest of the guys that we've talked to. And I tell you what, we'll give you 30 days, no obligation. If you come to us with some kind of interesting opportunity, for us to discuss, and we'll continue talking to you, but the parameters are, we own it, we control it, we have full and final say in everything that's done with it, period. We don't need to talk to you anymore. And so he came back with Playmates Toys and an animation company, and it was as such. So Peter and I had not only complete say and involvement, it was Peter's idea, which I thought was a great idea, to change the color, the red bandanas to the different color bandanas, so you could tell them apart more easily as a cartoon, as a toy character. We worked on all the original, we worked on all 300 original cartoon shows. We had final say on all the scripts, all the notes, all the design work, everything that you saw with a turtle on it. Probably the first 15 years of Turtles, we had full and final say. And so we knew that when we were going into the animated series, our black and white comics were written for an older audience. We knew specifically this was being done for a, you know, 4 to 6 year old audience.
Sure. No, I totally understand that, because I was talking to Ralph Paulson. And love he him. Could not say enough great things about you. And, you know, just working with you guys on the original cartoon series. And now he's involved with it again. And he's just like, Turtles. It's just like, this is my life.
No, Rob's, with that original crew, we actually, Courtney and I, have done a couple events, conventions with. And it's funny, if you've ever met Rob, who is the nicest guy ever. And but when you get Townsend Coleman and Cam Kennedy and Barry and all the original cast of the Turtles at a show, it's like the Three Stooges times, and they're very funny together. And they act out these whole scenes, and they do these little quartet, you know, the singing things, and it's like, that's an absolute riot. And it was great, and I love that when Nickelodeon came back around to do the 2012 series, that they did bring Rob back specifically. And he wasn't Raphael like he was in the first one. They gave him Donatello, and it was really
exactly so. Two sides of his personality, right there.
Yeah. Actually, it's a funny, I don't know if you guys knew this, is a funny factoid is, you guys know Chuck Lorre? Chuck Lorre is? He wrote the theme song for the group.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
You know, for years I'd forgotten, because, you know, again, back in those days, they had sent us all these cassette tapes of the theme songs, and the one that we picked out, which became the theme song. It was like years later when he became hugely successful with Two and a Half Men and Big Bang, and people like, well, you know, Chuck wrote the theme song for Turtles, the Turtles cartoon, and I was like, what? No way! And then Courtney, we were invited to a taping. Courtney and I got to not only sit in Sheldon's spot, not at the same time, separately,
but we got to sit on the couch.
We get to sit on the couch, and we get to meet Chuck Lorre. And he was fantastic, because he came up and he said, we met Chuck's daughter, who had said that Chuck basically said, he said, I was a hero to my child when she was in, you know, going through elementary school and things like that, because I wrote the Turtles theme song. So that was my claim to fame. So I said, now I want a cut of your career. He said no.
Do you guys have more questions?
This is a bit of a fanboy question, but I've had this argument with a lot of people. Are the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles superheroes?
Are they superheroes or not? They're, you know what? What I loved about comics when I was reading the comics, the kind of comics I was reading when I was growing up was like Spider-Man, for example, I guess I'd say my point to Spider-Man in particular, because he was more of a reluctant superhero. It was sort of like he got bit by the spider, he became this obtained these amazing mutant powers, and then when the forces of evil sort of cropped up and needed to be dealt with, he took it on for himself to be that hero, I think, which we all want to be. And we want to be that Indiana Jones, we want to be that hero, we want to step in and save the day. And so I felt like that was how we model the Turtles. Is like I always liked that they were intended to be sort of teenagers first, and but when they need to, they do the right thing and they step up. So I'd say superheroes, yes, but reluctant ones. They'd rather be playing video games or Fortnite or something. Sneaking into movies.
Sitting around eating pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Over the years, of course, there've been waves of movies and many series, comics, etc. Have you noticed any sort of pattern over the course of all these years? With sometimes the turtles die down a little bit, they're down on the roller coaster, and then they go back up.
Yeah, and that's that was what was amazing too. Is when you think about this is our 35th anniversary. This may be 35 years from first publication. Yeah, all your fault again. thank you.
35 years of issue 100 is coming up. I think there's some big celebrating happening.
Yes. Let me adjust my depends first. It's been a wonderful ride and a wonderful blessing in every imaginable sense of the word. But our agent, the agent that took it out initially, he said no, because he was great. He always had lots of great advice. He said, look, this is most boys' concepts of this type. You'll have an introductory year where you don't really make any money. You get paid a little bit to advances for the rights. But he said if it works, you'll have a second year, which would be the banner year, which you could potentially make some pretty good money. And then by year three, you're in the discount bins. So he said, save everything. And he said, talk to a financial person and, just make sure you take care of yourself first the best you can. And then, that just didn't stop. For a long time, I'd say the peak year being probably 89 and 90 with the movie. Yeah, the first movie was a huge hit, that was another interesting. Just as a digression, it was like every studio in Hollywood said no for the movie. They were like, "Are you guys drunk? Mutant Turtles? What?"
Well, the concept alone, I would imagine, looking at it, in order to pull this off, it's going to cost.
Yes, it was definitely a bunch of that, but we were blessed in so many ways that not only New Line Cinema saw the opportunity to invest in it, but distribution, but Golden Harvest, the main parent company that did the film, did all the Jackie Chan films, and had seen, it's like, oh, okay, we can put a martial artist in a rubber suit and get away with some of this. But Steve Barron, the director they brought in, had worked with Jim Henson on some storyteller episodes and some other things. And so he had great knowledge of animatronics and what could be done and what couldn't be done. So that perfect storm of all those things coming together was, how they squeezed, I think the total budget was around $7 million, which is, for 19, yeah. Yeah, it was a lot.
Well, that back then.
Now it's like you can't shoot a Pepsi commercial for that. But no, it was, but that was, it was a true independent movie, the way that it was done, the way that it was handled. And I think that's why, in many ways, it came out as good as it did. Because that will always be out of, going back to your question, is that there have been many versions, and the peaks were probably 91, 92, and then there was a sort of steadily, we had a presence in cartoons and stuff until 1996, 97, when I did, Pete took a short break when I worked on the live action series, which introduced Venus, which I know everybody loves as much as I do. I do. And then I stepped away from the Turtles when Pete came in and did the 2000 series, which is also one of my favorites. I think that series was, and that's what, oddly enough, that's what Tom and I refer to a lot. The 2000 series is part of some of the basis for the IDW comics that we're doing. Yeah, we've seen it sort of peaks and valleys, of course, and then the fact that, you know, every time it would be reintroduced and going back to the most recent reintroduction has been the most mind-blowing in that most of you folks that were fans of the original series, say you were 7, 8, 9 when it first came out, we do shows now, Courtney and I do about 15 shows a year, and we now see like whole families coming dressed as Turtles or fans of Turtles that, you know, because I always say that the biggest compliment and the huge, it is very humbling in its sense, is that you can't tell kids what's cool and what's not cool. They decide. And the fact that kids have found something after all these years in the Turtles is sort of, you know, what? I don't know. It's amazing. And that's it's pretty thrilling. It's, you know, as popular today as it's ever been.
Well, it's awesome probably for you to see, like, variations of the very first storyline that you guys came up with up on the big screen, either in cartoon or in the movies. Mm-hmm. And just, that's my work. And just probably geek out.
Yeah, I still, it's like, because we've seen, you know, people ask, like, okay, what's your favorite Turtle movie and what's your least favorite? And you guys probably know the answer in some respect. No, but the, one of the things I like, even there might be some of the Turtle, version of the Turtles that I might, a little less than others, or others I might like a little more than others. What's been so awesome is that the consistency of what, I guess Pete and I evolved the series to by, say, issue 11 or 12, which we only did, you know, full on 15, 16 issues together. We passed pages back and forth and wrote the stories, and then there was always a smattering of working together on different aspects. Was the idea that the Turtles were a family, and it's like four, you know, mutated characters that are basically orphaned. They have a surrogate father and a mutated rat. That's funny. And then, you know, April, being the first human brought into the Turtles universe, is kind of the surrogate sister in a sense. So we sort of built this whole family on Casey, April, four Turtles, and Splinters as the main heart and soul. And that seems to always be a constant in all the different things. And I think that's what binds it together for fans, even if you don't like the Michael Bay movies. There were some great things in the Michael Bay movies. We got to see Bebop and Rocksteady on the big screen for the first time, and things like that.
That's pretty awesome.
So, yeah, some stuff that, you know, I didn't particularly like them being 6 foot tall and bulletproof, but.
Hey, at least they're working on the robots. Yes, sir.
Speaking of things, do you think you would be perceived nowadays?
That's a good question, and it's possible, because I do wonder that, because a lot of people go, you know, at least around then, they said, why the heck did you do that? And what's weird is the very short version of the story is we had actually explored the idea with New Line Cinema for a fourth Turtle movie that never got made, which was introducing a fifth Turtle named Kirby, a male Turtle. He was sort of washed a little bit further down. It was a tribute to Jack Kirby, and then he was brought up differently, and it was, you know, we thought we came up with a good story. Made that work, and then when that movie failed to go forward, and then Haim Saban, which is why there was the crossover with the Power Rangers, wanted to do it. So we had developed that TV series with a fifth Turtle from the beginning, but it was a male Turtle named Kirby. And then Margaret Lesh, who was head of Fox Kids at that time, wanted to do a girl Turtle, and we said, you know, we love strong female characters. We love our, you know, Ripley, Sigourney Weaver. We love, Sarah Connor, you know, we love this, you know, this has always been a female friend, so I thought this would be well received as a thing for the Turtles line, but there was a lot of pushback, so I think it probably would have been, it would be more, you know, well received. We're all much smarter now.
Yes. More evolved.
More evolved, yes.
Absolutely. In addition to Turtles, of course, that's not all you've done. Company that I respect a lot, Andrew. Very much so. Talking about paying it forward to independent guys. I think that's where I discovered the Crow, James O'Mars, Crow, and as well as Mike Allred with Madman. Yes. That stuff was incredible. Talk about a little bit about the formation of Thunder.
Thunder was a wonderful experience for me, because I felt like, you know, Peter and I were, again, the industry is a, comics industry is changing so much. During this time, the evolution of black and white comics, the boom and bust, they call it, there was a lot of once the turtle succeeded, there was a lot of awareness and self-publishing. A lot more people were doing it and following the same footsteps that we were already following in. I always say that standing on the shoulders of giants, Peter and I were inspired by the Marvel, DC, and the other comics that we read and found our way into the business. And a lot of people wanted to pursue them as well, but just didn't have the opportunities. And what's even more interesting is, like, I'd go to comic conventions in the early days and be sitting with I had a number of conversations with Todd McFarlane and Eric Larson and some of those guys who were doing some of the most popular comics at Marvel and DC, and they're like, oh, man, we should be doing our own stuff, but we're stuck in this, stuck is not the most appropriate term, but they love doing Spider-Man, they love doing Hulk, and they love what they're doing, but they said, you know, we have a family, we have a mortgage, or we have rent, or we have this, and so it's hard for us to bust out from that monthly comic book schedule to, say, develop and do our own comic, our own thing. And this was consistent through whether it's, you know, Alan Moore, who started self-publishing, it was Frank Miller, who moved to... There was a huge discussion in that, so I thought that with the formation of Thunder, it was to do something kind of similar to what the Beatles did way back in the day with Apple Records, which is to set up a way to fund properties, fund projects that wouldn't normally be funded or have the opportunities to be exposed in a larger way, and then allow the creators to keep their rights to those characters. So that was the foundation of them, which was
a lot of great stuff came out of it.
Yeah, we did From Hell, and we did The Crow, said, and there was a lot of great stuff. I also did the Words and Pictures Museum around this time, which was a real other dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
That was awesome.
I think we have a young man out there with a question.
Captain America, one of my favorites.
Why did Donatello get a purple band?
That's a great question. We did, when we were choosing the colors for the headbands, we felt Raphael would keep to the original red bandana because he's kind of our Wolverine character, so he's kind of angry all the time. So red seemed to be fitting for him. Orange for Michelangelo seemed perfect because it's kind of a silly color, lighter, funner color. We've got a few Michelangelos over here. Leonardo with the blue, it was sort of a more regal royal color that akin to what the samurai might be, you know, because the samurais were very loyal and well trained and that kind of stuff. But Donatello was, his weapon was a bow staff, and that was a common weapon used by monks and often pacifists and people that weren't even allowed to train with weapons in those days, but you could. You know, someone well trained with a bow staff could disarm somebody with a sword in some cases. We liked the idea that it was more of a peaceful, pleasant color that seemed more in tune with technology and things that he would be interested in. So it was suited for Donatello. Thanks for the question.
Yes, I have four sons. He's going to start an initial.
No way.
David is my oldest, and he doesn't like getting stuck with purple.
Donatello's a smart one. We really love Donatello. Love him.
Which question? Just yell at the people.
I got a question. Do you have any advice someone might want to
do? Absolutely. Are you an artist or are you an artist writer or both?
Aspiring writer.
Aspiring writer, great. What's so interesting about what you can do today, and as the world gets smaller, and I use that term because, you know, with the internet and things like that, I used to spend a lot of time on a site called DeviantArt, and what was great about DeviantArt was they connected writers and artists from all over the world, normally people could join up with similar ideas and similar concepts. And or if you're a writer looking for an artist, I know there's a couple of other sites, comicart.org, and there's a few other ones, but the internet has allowed people to reach a wider audience quicker, easier, find people of like minds, like ideas and interests. If you like Doctor Who, you can go online and probably find a couple thousand Doctor Who-related websites and people to hang out with that all talk about Doctor Who kind of things, or so on and so on. So I feel like there's an opportunity for you to reach a wider audience to connect and get your word, your ideas, and your creations out there easier than word of mouth and what we did back in the day. That is a opportunity. It also, there's a lot of competition out there. So you have to be diligent, much like, you know, if you work at your craft, if you're writing, you need to write every day. And I know that not always easy. It's the same if you're drawing, if you're interested in music or sports, or it applies to all those kinds of things. If you want to get better, you have to do it every day, even if it's only for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but work hard at it, because it'll make a difference. And, you know, before you know it, if you're doing something every day to improve what you love, in writing, that, you know, suddenly you spend 365 days working at it and you're getting better. And I say Fitz's point specifically to, in relation to the Turtles and improving, is that when we did the first issue of the Turtles, which was 40 pages, the longest story I'd ever done was a 10-page story by myself, and Pete was about the same. So suddenly we were producing books like every 6 to 8 weeks, but they were 40-page books, and so we were literally drawing like 6 to 8 hours a week, and you could see how much we evolved as artists and writers, because we both wrote and drew them in that period of time. So don't give up the dream, work hard, and get the word out, and meet people with like minds and like ideas, and keep at it. Don't give up.
Okay. So, because my question is that being somebody that grew up in 1998, talk kind of this, your like Turtles, I and like it did, we've done a public show on Fox in 03, one of the Fox 3 created Fox Kids, and then Fox Fox, and then our that 4-part storyline runs close to the very end. So that's all I got to do. But that the reason why I knew about the Turtles is because my older brothers were born in the 80s, and so we had so many Ninja Turtle toys.
Did you get them all?
That be in the mountains of the Western that even had these sleds.
Yeah.
That weren't even Ninja Turtles. And so, yes, I did get his toys for a bit, but we ended up getting them all to the beat. Goodwill,
that kind of wish. Oh, that's nice.
But I kind of wish that we just like, but I don't think that really toys were the better because they were well played with.
Well loved.
Yes.
They were well loved.
Yes, yeah. That's how long we're. But about that, but my question is, looking back at like over 40 pages of the late 80s, did you ever get uncomfortable with just how much merchandise was being created, how much commercialized it was being with all the toys?
It was, you know, it's funny when we were, it's a really good question, by the way, and it's funny because it is, you know, I hear so many stories. A couple things happen when we do these shows that I love, besides meeting you all, is like, sometimes fans will bring up a book or a toy that, they'll bring up a toy that they've had since they were 4 or 5, and it's been chewed up, beat up, destroyed, and they would come up and practically apologize for, sorry, that's all I have for you to sign. I'm like, dude, you have, or, you know, ma'am, you don't know how incredibly cool this is that you not only love this when you were that age, but you still kept this all this time, and your mom didn't throw it away. All that stuff. But that's a huge compliment to me, and I love that I get the experience to see some of those old comic books, because my comic book collection is beat to hell because I read them all the time. And my mom didn't throw them away, thankfully, when we went to college. But there were, when we were going into licensing the Turtles, this was a new world to us in that, you know, we knew we had the toys, we had this, and then suddenly there was pajamas, and they were, and like, okay, really? Okay, yeah, I could see that. I would wear, you know, Superman pajamas when I was a kid, or Hot Wheels and stuff, and then, you know, each of these things kept adding on, and it was to the point that Pete and I would look at some of the Happy Meal things and some of the things and be like, what have we done? and the fact that they were selling, and then, you know, then it's funny, you know, reference how we do shows these days, but back in those days, when we do shows, say it was you, your brothers, and you might be about this tall, and your parents would be behind you. You might be excited to meet me, but your parents were really pissed off. and you could read their minds because they were thinking, like, you know how much money I've spent on Ninja Turtle underoos and Halloween costumes and how many, you know, Christmas Eves I stayed up putting together that stupid turtle sewer playset. Stepped on Leonardo's sword on the way to the restroom in the middle of the night. But there was some stuff. We had some restraint. I know it probably doesn't seem like it, but there were some things that we, you know, that didn't happen. But it was pretty amazing to go through that and to see it work in the way that it did, because it was overwhelming. And, you know, a lot of times though, when you're going through it, you don't realize it till you stop. And I remember going, like, the first time, I went to the movie premiere, for the first movie in Paris, and I'd never been to Paris before. So here in Paris for a movie premiere, so I'm standing looking at the Eiffel Tower, and there's this movie poster for the Turtles in French, and I'm like, what the? This makes no sense to me. It's amazing. So, you know, it was pretty crazy. It was, not many.
Okay, we got another question in the back.
Yeah, so I was just wondering about the run that Image did back in the 90s. It's probably the most mature, most dark series that's ever been with the Ninja Turtles. You know, with Raphael losing an eye and Leo losing an arm. I was just wondering if you think you might do any more stories like that with IDW, especially since IDW's reprinting that run, and it only had like 24 issues, I think.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you brought it up because we're literally right in the middle of that. I was, we finished the cover for issue 13 before flying here. But this, what was neat about this series, it was at a time when there was little or no publishing going on with the Turtles. Mirage Side, we had licensed, Simon Bisley and I did a book called Body Count with Image, which is considered the most violent turtle story ever done. But it was still in the spirit of the original self-publishing, older, edgier Turtles that we were doing. But that Image run was supposed to go 26 issues, but it only lasted, it was finally canceled out by issue 23, just there was not enough sales to keep it going. So when after a long discussion with Nickelodeon and IDW, Nickelodeon owns the Turtles, that they agreed to publish it again, but I was adamant, and my advice to them was like, don't even bother going there if you're not going to commit to doing the whole thing and finishing those last three issues with the original art team of Gary Carlson and Frank Fosco. And so that's what they're doing. So yeah, we're going to finish it in its entirety, but it is there's some pretty crazy stuff in there. It's more like the original Underground Turtle.
Cool. That's cool. That's cool.
If you don't mind my backtracking back thing, if me and this person were introduced...
You get a little closer to the microphone. You can move it down. There you go.
If you don't mind my backtracking back thing, if you think Venus versus modern incarnate, he's still being limited as a
No, I think it would be completely independent. In fact, I think that, you know, one of my favorite things about what Ciro Neely did with the 2012 Turtle series is I love that they took April's character and made her almost the same age as the Turtles. April's 16, the Turtles are, I think, technically 15 in the series. But she's got April has a number 5 on her shirt, and that's sort of our little symbol that she's the fifth Turtle. And so she's in there, you know, giving the boys as good as it gets, you know, dishing it out, and she's right on the front lines of them, like I think, you know, most women are today. So I think that she'd be very much be in that same spirit. And that's what I love, many, many things I liked about the 2012 series, besides Ice Cream Kitty. What a voice. Who was that actor? De Niro? Was it De Niro that did Ice Cream Kitty? But no, she would definitely be right in there with the voice. I grew up with three sisters, so it was like, I got beat up a lot by girls.
Okay, Steve, you got a question for us?
I have two questions, if that's okay with y'all.
Sure,
okay. Yeah, but also, for those great work, and what is your current project you're doing right now?
Say that again, please.
What is your current project that you're working on?
Oh, the current projects I'm working on now? Thanks. We actually, it's funny, it's very interesting that I'm going back to self-publishing starting this May, and thanks to a lot of fans that supported, I did Kickstarter last year with co-creator, writer Ben Avalone, and David Avalone, and artist Ben Bishop. Ben Bishop and I did the Turtles Target R series last year, which was fantastic. He's a fellow artist with Maine. And so we did a Kickstarter. We raised the funds to do 4 issues, which is the first part of 12 full story segments called Drawing Blood. And we're going back to self-publishing issue 1 starting in May, and we'll run through all 12 issues at the sales if you guys support us. And it's based on completely fictional true story. It's got some semi-autobiographical moments, but it's sort of a bit of Spinal Tap, a little Amadeus, a little Breaking Bad, sort of isms about a fictional character named Shane Bookman, and his whole world is based in our world, the world of comic books. So it's sort of what he went through with early success, how he messed that up, and sort of him looking for his mojo, looking for his creativity again, while he's haunted and tortured by the characters he created, which are the radically rearranged Ronin Ragdolls, these three samurai cats named Miyazaki, Tezuka, and Otomo, named after favorite Japanese animators. That's probably the main project I'm working on right now, is Drawing Blood. I've got a few other things we're doing, but that's my first original. Creating, I've done lots of other projects, but this is, I had to live through all of those stuff to arrive at Drawing Blood, which I'm so excited about as a series. I think you guys get a big kick out of it.
Sounds real cool. And another question too, being a gamer and everything, like, what is your favorite sort of video game of them all?
I'm terrible at them. I'm really terrible at them. I like the arcade game because I like you could play it with, like, you know, full on with, you know, back, you know, these days that our son is online with like 10 of his friends playing Fortnite or Rocket League or something. And but back then, that was the first game you could get, you know, three other friends and all play. So I like the Turtles arcade game. Thanks for your question. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, very cool. I don't think I want to leave here without asking you about heavy metal.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
That was my next question.
Tell us, because you mentioned earlier how heavy metal was an influence to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So what prompted you to get behind the publishing arm of it?
Well, what was amazing with heavy metal is that I mentioned earlier, I discovered it. At the time, it was interesting. At a time when I was kind of growing out of comic books a little bit, only because I love the medium, but comic books during the 70s, especially the mid-70s, was sort of regulated by this authority called the Comics Code Authority. And it was this kind of silly system set up to regulate comics for kids only. So they were heavily regulated to, to be for 12 and under or even younger. And about the time, I love them. I still love comic books, but I was starting to grow out of them. And then I discovered Heavy Metal Magazine, which not only published some of the underground comics artists that became a big influence, but a lot of European artists, which for a lot of these European artists like Mobius and Blyle and so many other fantastic talents, they evolved while American comics stayed sort of stagnant. And so the first time I went to a comic store in Paris, you saw business professionals, you saw women, you know, back when it was very rare to see a female fan in a comic store back in the early 80s. So that was really the eye-opening for me in that my commitment was reaffirmed and cemented, if you will, that comics are for all ages. And it's not like, you know, that thing that, when I get made fun of in sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade, you still read comic books? I was a geek back when it was not a cool thing. But what was great about heavy metal is I discovered that it was this whole new world and empowered me greatly and a lot of other artists. So with the success of the Turtles, I found myself having a conversation with somebody who said in the late 80s that heavy metal was for sale. So I used some of my Turtle money and I bought Heavy Metal Magazine in 1990 and published it. And I'm still publisher of the magazine. I don't own it fully like I used to, but I do. But it was one of those things that was a dream come true in that I still, for probably, this is probably 1990 to 2011, I pretty much picked every single story that went in the magazine, covers, everything. It was like, there was only a four-person company, but I ran and did everything with it. It was one of those jobs that was definitely not a job.
It's definitely nice to see it in the last few years get sort of another boost with Greg Morrison being involved.
Yep, that was the way the partner, Jeff Perlitz, came in. He bought into the company, and he really had some great ideas to expand and grow the company because newsstand distribution had changed so much, and there were so many things that we really had to refocus, many, many things. And that was Jeff's idea to bring in Grant Morrison, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, and it really changed the dynamic on a number of things. And it's more, we're selling more copies of the magazine today on into its 40th year than we were 10 years ago.
Has there been any talk about maybe another movie or more multimedia?
No, I'm laughing because of... There's a new series coming out of Netflix called Love, Death, and Robots, which originally was called Heavy Metal. A couple years ago, 2008, 2009, I worked with David Fincher and Tim Miller, who directed Deadpool, and we tried to raise money to do a Heavy Metal movie. We spent 4 years trying, we couldn't. I spent a couple years with Robert Rodriguez also trying to raise money to do a Heavy Metal movie, and sort of as things have evolved, I think that Heavy Metal as a brand is a little less important for the marketing people in Hollywood, and it's still a cool thing to the creative people. But I think I'd still love to see a Heavy Metal movie, and I haven't given up hope on doing a new one, fully branded Heavy Metal.
First one's still one of my favorites.
Oh yeah.
enjoyed this very, very much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When we reviewed it for our podcast, we were like, there's got to be more. There's got to be more. Your stuff is just right.
Thank you. No, I'd love to. I would love to see another thing, especially what Ivan Reitman did in the original one. Was so awesome.
Exactly. Question.
You mentioned that Donnie being cast as a huge part of his character. In the 2012 iteration, what do you think of the addition of Lee on the staff?
It was fun. It was funny. It was funny. Yeah, they kill stuff. They started drinking. No, what was it? Because I liked, because that was, what I loved what Ciro Neely did with the series is that he did, he went back to actually kind of like what we did with the 90W series. We looked at a bunch of different Turtle universes to create a new universe to tell stories in. And I liked, Michelangelo, they made Mikey goofier, but he had a different kind of blade. He had part nunchuck and part something else. And with Donatello, was one of those things that, so I think we evolved it into a series. He also, I think we did the blade for a period of time, and then I think we all thought that was a little too on Donatello, so then we made it into a steel, I think a solid bow staff. But yeah, there was a, it's funny, I was talking to another person today, because, you know, you didn't get the joke, I do the voice of Ice Cream Kitty, or I did the voice of Ice Cream Kitty. And I just remember, like, when Sarah would do some of his ideas, and I'd read some of the, as I used to go up there all the time, and himself, I wrote a couple episodes and stuff, but some of the stories were really messed up. I'm like, what? You know, and he would bring in some, like, he did Robert Englund, he did Freddy, you get the voice of Freddy to do a voice, and James Hong from Big Trouble in Little China, and he would, like, even the episode of The Birth of Ice Cream Kitty, which was this reintroduction or the introduction of Rat King as a character into the storyline, and it was just the death of Ice Cream Kitty to be reborn into this cat mane of Ice Cream was like, that's scary as hell. I'm like, Ciro, dude, he can, like, you know, do it off camera, but he's got the cat going. and then Rat King as a character was really scary. And then they did this one episode that, like, the pizza zombies was this guy throwing pizzas on these people's head, and they turn into these zombies. So yeah, we tried a bunch of different things, but it's still one of my favorite all-time Turtle series. The exploration was really neat, and I'm glad we got to finally bring in Usagi Yojimbo fully back into the Turtles universe.
Yes. Pretty awesome. I'm just going to wrap up our time.
Yes, I think it works.
You're still going to be on the floor?
No.
Actually, they're leaving.
Yeah, so it was already No, sorry, we came in Friday. We had a pizza party with a whole bunch of y'all. It was just really super fun. We had an incredibly wonderful and exceptionally fun filled day yesterday. Thanks for standing in those lines. You guys are crazy. I love you. I always joke I wouldn't stand in line to see me. I'm a little glad you guys do. And I always like to say that I get to sit up here and I get to sit behind that table because I have the best. I have the best job in the world because I have the best fans in the world. So I really appreciate you coming and hanging out.
From all of us here at South Carolina Comic Con, thank you for everything.
Thank you. We've had a blast with you guys. Thank you very much.